Thanks for tuning in to the Lean 911 podcast, where you'll have a voice directly from the Gemba. I will rely on my three decades of Lean successes, as well as my failures, to answer your most challenging questions regarding your Lean transformation. I'm your host, Mark DeLuzio, President and CEO of Lean Horizons Consulting, and the principal architect of the Danaher Business System. Looking forward to your questions. Now, let's go to the Gemba. Mark DeLuzio here with Art Byrne. Art, this is the third time you've been on my podcast. We're starting to make this a habit, I guess, which is good. And this is episode 41. And if you go back to episode, I want to go back to episode 38. It was the Lean Turnaround Answer Book. We reviewed Art's new book that just came out, which was a compilation of all the things that he wrote for LEI on his blog. It's an unbelievable book because it answers a lot of the things that simply, you know, nobody talks about, nobody knows to do with. It's all the tacit knowledge that you really need to drive a lean transformation. So that's a phenomenal book, along with his other two books, The Lean Turnaround and The Lean Turnaround Workbook. So those three books right there, if you're doing a transformation, I don't know what's left on the table after those three books, because if you can even implement half of what's in there, you'd be doing really well for yourself. The next one that we did, Art, was episode 40, which was How to Create a Lean Culture. And that kind of comes right out of your book as well. And that was a very interesting one of the things that you laid out in terms of what we really need to do to think of what we need to think about when it comes to a lean culture. That's a phenomenal book. And today, episode 41, and this also comes out of the Lean Turnaround Answer Book, is it's a chapter out of that. It's called The Early Days of Danaher. And Art and George Koenigsaker hired me in 1987. That's about when it started. Actually, technically started in 86, I think, but not with Shingijutsu. Shingijutsu, again, being the five of the 10 engineers that Ono handpicked to help implement the Toyota Production System. So we learned it right from the horse's mouth, if you will, with guys like Iwata and Nakao. Jeez, if I can name all the other ones, Nino, Niwa, and Takanaka. Those five were the original five for Shingijutsu, and then they grew that company over the course of time. But they were heavily involved in the initial transformation of Danaher, which ultimately revolved into the Danaher Business System and also revolved into the Wiremold production system when Art became CEO of Wiremold after he left Danaher. So that's a little bit of history here. So Art, I'm going to just turn it over to you and start talking about the old days. You know, there's so many things that went on and so many things that we did that we didn't really think we were making history back then, but we were just trying to do the right thing and get ourselves out of a hole, because the Jake Break was in a hole, and as were some of our other companies. But you were group executive and you had half the company at that time. So I'm going to turn it over to you and let you just start talking about the old days.
Hey, thanks, Mark. Nice to be back with you again. Danaher is interesting, and I think certainly these days a lot of people have heard about the success that Danaher has had over time, and you were a key driver of that with the Danaher Business System. But at the time, like you said, we were just trying to survive. We weren't trying to do anything fancy. But let me just sort of set the stage. You know, Danaher at that time was about $1 billion in sales. It had 13 separate companies, none of them related to each other, really. I had, there was two group executives, myself and a guy named John Cosentino. And our office was, she had a secretary, the two of us, and our office was in the Jake Break building in Bloomfield, Connecticut. And of the businesses that I had, Jake Break, which made engine retarders for Class 8 diesel trucks, was really kind of in trouble when we got there. It was, you know, we could have lost that business, to tell you the truth. And its sister company, Jacobs Chuck, wasn't doing too well either. Jacobs Chuck made drill trucks for electric tools. It was based in South Carolina, in Clemson, South Carolina. So The Rales brothers were headquartered down in Washington, D.C. The headquarters was in a little old house that was under the Key Bridge down in Washington, D.C., right on the Potomac River. The total staff there was the two Rales brothers, two assistants, and maybe five or six finance guys. That was the whole overhead of Danaher at the time. So we really had a very, very low overhead. And Cosentino and I were responsible for the day-to-day kind of running of the business. So that's sort of the overview. Now, when we get into my businesses, we really had to do something about Jake Brake because we were really in a lot of trouble. We were having trouble making the product. We were late with deliveries, et cetera, et cetera. And so myself and George Konensaker, who I had appointed as president of Jake Brake, the two of us were the only people in Danaher at that time that had any experience with what was then called just-in-time.
Right.
Konensaker had it from his experience at John Deere and at Rockwell. And myself, my first exposure to just-in-time was my first general manager job at the General Electric Company in the lighting business group. We implemented just a simple Kanban system at the time. And later on, a professor out in Washington State, I think maybe the University of Washington, I think his name was Schoenberger. He wrote a piece or did a video saying that what we did was the first really just-in-time implementation within the General Electric at that time. So anyway, we were the only ones that had any kind of knowledge at all of just-in-time. We decided to try and fix Jake Brake using this approach. And to begin with, our auditors at the time was Arthur Anderson, and they had a consulting arm, Anderson Consulting, who claimed to know all about just-in-time, and they could really help us. So we talked to the Rales brothers, and they allowed us to start to use Anderson Consulting. And they were somewhat helpful. They were a typical U.S. consulting company, lots of PowerPoint presentations, lots of young guys just out of school running around doing things. But we did form the first couple of cells to manufacture product. They weren't very good, but we had a couple. And at the time, we were reading as much as we could about just in time. And there was a great book out called Kaizen by a guy named Maki Inoue. And so we had been reading that book and learned a lot from that. And then Konensaker discovered that, gee, Amai is having a 1 week seminar on just in time. And he's holding it right down in Hartford, Connecticut, which was like two towns away from us in Bloomfield. So George signed up about five of his people, and I went for the first 2 days. I couldn't go the next 3 days. And we went down to see what this was all about. Well, Amai wasn't really a consultant himself per se. He didn't really have that much just-in-time experience himself, but so he needed someone to do this. So he brought in the three original founders of Shunjujutsu, Iwata, Takanaka, and Nakao. And they conducted the first 2 days of the seminar. And then there was 3 days it was going to be in somebody's factory trying to do a little Kaizen. So Konensaker and I, through the first 2 days, we said, you know, they're with Arthur Anderson, they're going too slow. They cost too much money. We don't like all the PowerPoints. These are the guys we need. These are the guys who created this whole thing at Toyota. We need to get these guys to come and help us. So Konensaker badgered them all week long. They came back on a he brought them to the plant one night about midnight. They almost caused a riot, trying to move things around. And then I think I met with them again on Thursday afternoon. And then we had them back on Saturday morning before they left town. We were begging them to come and help us. And their response was, look, we're too old. We don't speak English. It's too far away, et cetera, et cetera. And we said, yeah, but we really, A, we really need the help. And B, we have great steaks. We have great lobster. And we have golf. We have lots of golf. Well, I think golf won the day because they were all three really golf fanatics. So anyway, they agreed that they would come and see what they could do with us. So the first meeting that we had with them was in August, and I wanted to start in Jacob's Chuck because we needed to fix Jacob's Chuck and Jacob's Brake. So The first day was going to be at Jacob's Chuck, and the rest of the week was going to be at Jake Brake. So anyway, we're down in South Clemson, South Carolina, at Jacob's Chuck. It's August. It's really hot. We're running around in blue jeans and golf shirts. The three consultants show up in suits and ties, and we say, "Well, gee, how are we going to work with these guys? We've got some consultants from the University of Clemson. I mean, some interpreters. I mean." And so we said, well, what we'll do is we'll have an introduction, and then we'll have about a 45-minute discussion describing a drill chuck, and then we'll take a plant tour, and then we'll see where we go from there. So that was our plan. So the introduction went okay. The discussion on drill chucks lasted about 10 seconds because Nakao said, "Yeah, we have those in Japan too. What do you want to do next?" And we said, "How about a plant tour?" And they said, "Oh, plant tours. We like plant tours." So we figured a plant tour was going to take an hour and a half, something like that was normal for us. So we get out in the plant. We get about 100 yards, maybe not even 100 yards into the plant. And Iwata holds up his hand and he says, "Okay, we've seen enough. Let's go back." And we said, "But Mr. Iwata, we just started." He says, "That's okay. Come on, let's go back." So we get back in the conference room. Iwata goes up to the board, and in big letters, he writes on the board, "No good." And he turns around and says, "Look, everything here is no good. What do you want to do about it?" So I would imagine the average US company that brought in a consultant, took a quick peek at their factory, turned around and told them everything was no good, they would probably throw the guy right out. But we already knew it was no good. We wanted them to help us. So anyway, we started, and we formed a team to look at our industrial chucks because that we were having the most trouble with those. So Iwata says, "Okay, Nakao Takanaka, you go work with that team." And we had about seven or eight of our engineers and managers on that team with them. And then Iwata says, "But I like assembly. I'm going to work on assembly." So the president of Jacob's Chuck, Dennis Claremont, and I, so let's go with Iwata. Let's see what he has to say. So we go out in the assembly area, and we had about four of these conveyor belt assembly lines putting the final touches on the chucks, putting them in a box, et cetera. First thing Iwata says, of course, is, "Look, I hate assembly lines. Get rid of the assembly lines. I mean, I hate conveyor belt assembly lines. Get rid of those." So we were like, "Yikes, you know." But then he showed us, he talked to us and explained why, and we went in and out of the office. And anyway, in the midst of doing this, the other team kept coming in to see Dennis, and they looked upset and they were whispering in his ear. And I said, "Dennis, what's the matter?" He said, "Well, my guys are all upset." I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, the Japanese, they want to move a bunch of equipment over lunchtime. We haven't moved this equipment in 10 or 15 years." I said, "Well, what did you tell them?" He says, "Well, I told them to go ahead and move it." I said, "Great, we'll go out after lunch, see what's going on." So we go out after lunch, and there's the two consultants. So they got their ties, the ties are tucked into their shirts, they got the sleeves rolled up, and they got pry bars. They got these pry bars underneath a couple of machines, trying to free them up from all the oil that sort of sucked them onto the ground. And all of our guys are standing around with their mouths open. And I said, "Dennis, I like these guys. I like these kind of consultants. There's been no PowerPoint presentation. They're just doing stuff. Right away, we're doing stuff." So that day, we formed the first cell. We got rid of one of the conveyor belt assembly lines in assembly. And then the rest of the week, we spent at Jacob's Brake doing basically the same thing. Out on the shop floor right away, moving things and starting to make things happen. So that's how we started with Shinjitzu, and it was very, very dramatic. And Konnenseker and I early on, because Konnenseker finally he basically took the lead. You came in right around the time we were getting started with them, or just a little before. And Konnenseker was sort of a bull in a china shop, if you will. He was going
Oh, yeah.
really fast. We had his operations guy was named Bob Pentland, was a real character, but really smart. And the two of them were moving everything and going fast. And we decided that, look, every time we create a new cell or do something, let's clean the place up, because Jake Brake looked like a cave. I mean, it was dirty and dark and whatever. So every time we created a cell or whatever, we painted the ceiling, we painted the floors, we cleaned everything up. We even had potted plants in the first two cells just to make it look different and be a different thing. And I think one of the things that was really important early on was that in addition to doing that, the cleanup as we moved along, Konnenseker and I decided that, look, whatever these guys tell us, we're going to do it, no matter whether we think it's the stupidest thing we ever heard. And I would say about 50% of the time, it was the stupidest thing we ever heard. And then on top of that, we always did what they said. But on top of that, of course, about 50% of the time, it didn't work. You know, we created a cell or we did something, and then it, right away it didn't work. So what are we going to do now? Well, there was a lot of pressure on us from our internal managers to say, okay, that didn't work. We told you it wasn't going to work. Let's go back the way we were. And we said, the one thing we're going to make sure is we're never going to allow it to go backwards. We're always going to do whatever they tell us, and we're going to never let it go backwards. And I think those two decisions were really key to some of the gains that we eventually got in Jake Break, for sure. Because, you know, what we said is, instead of letting it go backwards, we understood why we created a cell. We understood what the rationale was. And so let's just fix it. You know, we only created it because the rationale made a lot of sense. This made a lot of sense to do this.
Right.
So going backwards made no sense at all. So that's what we did. We just stuck with it, et cetera. And so we started to make pretty good progress, both at Jake Break and at Jacob's Chuck. We had the Shin Jiu-Jitsu come back. They were with us for 1 week a month as we went forward. We were the only client in the United States at that time. And in fact, we were their only client in the United States for 4 years. The next 4 years, they stayed with us, and we were their only client, which was great because we were learning a tremendous amount. It was like drinking through a fire hose, if you will. You know, we tried to spend, whenever they were in town, we tried to spend time on the floor with them the whole time. And then at night, we'd take them to dinner and pump them for more information. We heard a lot of great Ono stories during those dinners. But because they, you know, they really, you know, they work for Ono, but they learned with Ono, and they were scared stiff of Ono. But on the one hand, on the other hand, they revered the guy. I mean, he was a god to them. But we heard a lot of great stories about him, and we just kept asking him for information. We played golf with them on the weekends when they came. And I remember, funny story, they were so fanatical about golf. And I said, look, you know, I want to take you, I'm going to buy you each a set of golf clubs. I'm going to keep them in my office so that when you're here, I don't want to hear any more complaining about, hey, we have to play with rental clubs or anything like that. These are going to be your clubs that you picked out. So to get the clubs, I take them down to this place in Hartford called the Golfer's Warehouse. Great big golf outlet, all kinds of clothing and about six or seven hitting bays. And they even had some PGA Tour pros to help you do the golf fitting, right? The club fitting. So we get out of the car, and Iwata looks up and sees the sign that says Warehouse, Golfer's Warehouse. And he says, oh, Warehouse. I hate Warehouse. Well, I said, Iwata-san, don't worry. You're going to really like this Warehouse. You will like.
I never heard that story. That's great.
I couldn't get out of there. It took 3 or 4 hours to get out. So they finally get fitted for a set of clubs each. And then they say, hey, do you mind if we buy another set ourselves? Because we want to send them back to Japan. I said, no, I said I'd buy you one set. But if you want to buy another set or three more sets, it's up to you. And at the time, the clubs that they could buy at the Golfer's Warehouse cost about a third of what those same clubs would cost in Japan by the time you went through exporting them and the taxes and everything else. So they each bought another set. They were so happy. But anyway, as we went along.
And by the way, Art, they were pings. I recall they were pings.
Yeah, well, most of them got pings, and the cow got some special beryllium copper heads and all this stuff. It was really, and then, you know, when we would do the consulting at night, Nakao was a real golf fanatic. He would take a putter and a wedge into his room at night and chip into the couch or chip onto the bed and putt and all this stuff. And like, it was,
you know, I had him over for dinner one night in Glastonbury, Connecticut. I lived on a golf course there. And my son was 13. My older son was 13. And Nakai was teaching him how to putt. And after we had dinner and I took him home, I said to my son, do you realize that you just got taught by the greatest engineer in the world? Okay. Bar none, he's the greatest engineer, in my opinion, in the world. You got taught by an iconic guy And it didn't real he didn't it didn't mean anything to him at the time, you know, but it was like he taught you how to putt, you know. Always a teacher. He was always a teacher.
He was really into golf at that time. And I agree with your comment, though, that I think Nakao is the most clever engineer I ever met. You know,
Yeah.
he could look at a piece of machinery and tell you how it was designed and how it was built and what the internal guts look like, and et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, we were making a lot of progress at Jake Break, and you know, we were freeing up a lot of space, and we were roping it off so that people couldn't put stuff back into it, if you remember.
Yeah, we
And
had
then,
basketball courts, we had tennis courts. Yeah, right.
we
Yeah.
had all that stuff because we freed up so
Yeah.
much space. And of
Yeah.
course, at the time, the way that Danaher was run, myself and Cosentino would fly down to Washington, D.C. once a month and have a meeting with the Rales brothers and give them an update on all of our companies and how things were going. And so I was, of course, bragging about what we were doing with Shin Jiu-Jitsu and how Jake Brake and Jacobs Chuck were coming along, et cetera, et cetera. But the finance team down in Washington, of course, they're looking at the numbers. And, you know, as you know, when if you're on standard cost accounting and you start dropping the inventory like a stone, the earnings don't look too good because
Exactly.
you're getting a double hit of overhead because there's no place to absorb it anymore. So they were, you know, on the one hand, I'm telling them, this is great. You should see what we're doing. We're learning how bad we are. You know, I was saying things like that. And the Rales brothers, they said, well, wait a minute, the earnings look, we're gonna have to have a special emergency meeting to see what we're gonna do. You know, I mean, what's going on up there? We don't like the numbers. So we said, okay. So we arranged the meeting and they're gonna come up. And Konasekara and I said, well, look, the worst thing for us would be to go in a conference room and talk about the numbers. That's not going to work for us at all because you know, we know what the numbers look like. So let's start with a plant tour. We'll take them out in the plant. We'll show them the space we freed up. We'll show them all the painted areas where everything is looking better, whereas the old part of the plant was still a mess and dirty, et cetera. And then Konatseka came up with the brilliant idea, I thought. He said, well, let's have the UAW give them the tour. Because of course Jake Brake was a UAW location,
Yeah, and
and
negotiate their contracts. Yeah, right.
so we had George arranged to, every time we made a stop, we'd go to this cell, we'd go to this place, and the UAW members, the operators on the floor, they would tell the story. We helped them put it together, et cetera, but they were very enthusiastic, and you know, we were out on the floor for about 3 hours, if I remember correctly, and this was going very, very well. And then we went back up in the office and we said, well, this might not be very good. You know, we started looking at the numbers. But that never happened. When we got upstairs, and I always say this is to the Rales brothers' great credit, in my opinion, they never wanted to look at the numbers after seeing what we were doing and see what was happening.
Actually, I will tell you what I remember about that day. I had been promoted. You guys promoted me to CFO, and when they did come up to that office, and it wasn't a long meeting, all I did is show them the cash flow statement. Okay, that's why you need to show them, because at the end of the day, you know. And by the way, that absorption hit is a temporary hit. You know, it happens once. You know, over the course of a few months, as you're taking inventory down. But when I showed them the cash flow statement, they got it. These guys were smart anyway. They understand cash. And that's a lot. That's what happens with a lot of CFOs out there. It's, oh, you know, if we don't build inventory, we're gonna take a P&L hit. Yeah. But you can't take percentages to the bank, but you can take cash to the bank, right? And they got it, you know. But by the way, just to let you know, when I started what we now call lean accounting there. And I remember you had Ori Fumi call me, your CFO at Wiremold, to put it in at Wiremold. We had an auditor come down from corporate to look at what we were doing. And he came down and he was complimentary. Oh, this is great, blah, blah, blah. Then he wrote a scathing report about our cost accounting practice. I got rid of standard costs. I got rid of variance analysis. Was all those variances were counter to lean thinking. They made you do the wrong things: build inventory, purchase price variance, buying big quantity discounts, right? And he didn't understand. He was a CPA. I'm a CMA. He didn't understand that what you do with your management accounting system doesn't have to be GAAP compliant or anything. For example, if somebody bought 6 months worth of tooling, that hit them that month. I didn't amortize it. Yeah, financially, we'll amortize it because you've got to do that per, GAAP accounting and all that. But I didn't allow that to happen. I said, no, if you bought 6 months worth of tooling, you're going to get hit this month. Go explain to Bob Pentland why your costs went through the roof, right? Well, I got a good deal. Yeah, what if the design changes, So this guy wrote a scathing report on our what we now call lean accounting, right? And they just didn't get it. CPAs and financial guys just don't get it. And it's a
Yeah.
real problem. You were lucky to have Ori Fiume because he got it, So,
I was extremely lucky to have Ori about that because
yeah.
he really did get it, and eventually he wrote the book Real Numbers, which has
Real
been
numbers, yeah.
one of the better books on lean accounting that is still out there.
Yep.
So anyway, we get up in the conference room, and like you said, the meeting was short. The Rales brothers just looked at us and said, "How fast can you do this in the rest of Danaher?" So George and I were like, "Oh, well, we didn't get fired. That was a good thing." So we said, "Well, I don't know. We'll call up Shin-Jujitsu and we'll ask them and we'll get them started and we'll work on that." So that was the end of the meeting. They went back. We were still employed, and that was good. And so we called up Shin-Jujitsu, and Shin-Jujitsu, we said, "We want you to help us in all the other Danaher companies. There's 11 other companies." And they said, "No." We said, "Well, what do you mean, no? We want your help." They said, "No, we're not going to help you because Jacobs Brake and Jacobs Chuck are so bad that until we get them looking better and more realistic, we're just going to focus on those two." So we said, "Okay, well, we told the Rales brothers we'd spread this to the rest of Danaher. So what are we going to do? How are we going to do this?" So myself and Koenigsegger and Cosentino, the other group executive, we came up with this concept of the president's Kaizen. And the reason we did that was because we understood very, very early on that if the presidents of our companies didn't lead the charge to converting so just in time, then
Right.
that wasn't going to happen. It had to come from them. We couldn't force it, whatever. So they had to learn it and they had to do it. And that's, as you know, and your can everything you've seen over the years, that's still true. If the CEO or owner of the business doesn't commit to becoming a lean expert and really driving this stuff, it'll never happen. It just won't happen.
Exactly.
And so we said, okay, we understood that. So let's take all 13 Danaher presidents and their VPs of operations, take them to Japan for a week. Shin-Jujitsu set up a tour for us, and I think we saw about eight different companies and tour, including a couple of Toyota plants, but mostly it was Shin-Jujitsu's other clients. It was Isuzu and Yamataki Honeywell and some of those kind of companies. So all
Yep.
different. So you
Yep.
could see lean in a lot of different places. And the presidents, they were kind of complaining about this a little bit, et cetera. But then when they came back, Cosentino and I said, "Look, now we have to force them to do Kaizen and learn Kaizen." And so we what we did is we Cosentino said, "Well, if we're going to do that, we're going to do it in my plants because you've been the one that's had Shin-Jujitsu. I haven't had him yet." I said, "Fine." I said, "That's fine. We'll use all your factories." So what we did is we said every 6 weeks, all the presidents had to come to one of Cosentino's factories for 3 days and be on the shop floor doing Kaizen. Well, of course, as you can imagine, their first reaction to that is, "Wait a minute, I'm the president of a company. I don't need to be on somebody's shop floor doing this stuff, blah, blah, blah." And of course, what happened was we got such tremendous results every time that we did this that after about one or two times, all the presidents, they would just clear their calendars and say, "I got to be on the next Kaizen. I'm learning so much myself from doing this." So that was how lean kind of started to spread around Danaher a little bit from doing these president's Kaizens. And you continued them in Danaher as you went along, and I certainly continued them in Wiremold. And then later on, when I got into the private equity business, we had president's Kaizens there as well within some of the businesses, and it turned out to just be a wonderful tool to get people to understand what's this all about, right? What are we trying to do here? One of my companies in the private equity business, It's a company called Acelte, made filing products. These are hard filing products. So as you can imagine, if you're making file folders and three-ring binders and lever arch files, that kind of stuff, and along comes laptops and cell phones, and people are starting to store things on their computers and stuff, not in hard filing. The business was declining at the rate of about 4% a year the whole time we owned it. But we were doing a lot of Kaizen, and the biggest factory they'd had in Europe was in Poland. And every summer we had a board meeting there, and we had a week-long Kaizen, and we had all the key management people for SLT Europe come into Poland and spend a week on the shop floor doing Kaizen. Same thing, President's Kaizen. And in that case, we had John Childs, who was, of course, the head of J.W. Childs Associates and basically effectively the owner of Acelte. We had myself as the chairman of Acelte. We had the worldwide president, CEO of Acelte, who was based in the US. He was there. And then we had the president of Acelte Europe, also all of us on the shop floor for the whole week doing Kaizen. And the results, again, that we got were astronomical. But the bigger gain was the mentality change, the culture change from people doing this, you know. And when we started it at Danaher, it was a really interesting thing, because we'd go to one of Cosentino's companies, and the people on the shop floor would say, "Gee, you know, we're really impressed that Danaher would allow all of its presidents to come down here for 3 days on our shop floor trying to help us get better. We're impressed that you would do that. But we've been here, we've been working here for 15, 20 years. You're not going to be able to achieve anything in 3 days. We haven't gotten anything done in 20 years." And by the end of 3 days, what they would be saying was totally different. They'd say, "Hey, wait a minute. You're not going to go away and leave us with them, are you?" Because the them, of course, was their direct management, who hadn't listened to them in 20 years every time they made a suggestion. And all the gains we got in 3 days, as you can imagine, came from the suggestions of the people on the shop floor that said, "Well, this is broken, and this is," and all we did was listen to them and fix the stuff,
Your
right?
best consultants, right? I mean, yeah,
Yeah, well,
exactly.
you know, the people doing the work always have the best ideas as to how to remove the waste from the work, because they understand that. And so the president's Kaizens, that's where we got the gains, and we got tremendous gains. I remember one, I forgot the factory we went to, but we started out the first day that was taking 14 people to do this work. By the end of day three, we could do the same work with three people. You know, and that was pretty typical, pretty natural to see
And,
that come.
again, I just want to point out too, Art, that if you don't, companies today are, and some of my clients as well, are reluctant to guarantee no layoffs because of lean improvements. We had that guarantee. We even had it with the UAW. We said,
Yeah.
no layoffs. If we free up, you went from what, 13 to three or whatever it was, you free
Yeah,
up 10 people, those people are not going to lose their job. Okay. And
that's
that
right.
is so key to this.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you look at Jake Brake over time, think about what happened there. You're right. We made that guarantee early on. And over time, as we fixed Jake Brake and things really, really improved, Jake Brake had, I think, a 29% productivity gain every year for the first 5 years, something like that. It was a tremendous.
All right, we went from when I started, we were like I think three or four brake kits per 100 man hours, and we ended up somewhere in the 40s
Yeah,
in about 5 years. Okay.
well,
It was incredible.
yeah. Well, that kind of thing was going on, you know. As Shin-Jujitsu finally started to help us in Danaher, we were
Right.
getting those kind of gains there as well. And you know, I just think that the gains that we got, and we weren't making a lot of noise about this. We weren't going to the security analysts or saying anything or
No.
whatever. We were just quietly fixing Danaher, every business. And the gains were just astronomical every place.
But I think it's important to point out too, nobody worked harder. Actually, they worked easier because they weren't firefighting, there weren't, things going wrong. Yeah, there were things going wrong, of course, but when things stabilized over time and the work actually got easier. And then that one chart I think you and I worked on, we went from like a 60 some odd million dollar company with 500 people to about a 220, $230 million company with the same headcount. All UAW, all UAW.
But that's the whole idea of job guarantee, is that
Right.
you give a job guarantee in order to get Kaizen done and to do that. But what you're trying to do is to double or triple, or in JBreak's case, almost quadruple the business with the same number
Right.
of hands.
Right.
And when I went to Wormhole, one of the first things I did there was to say, look, we're going to be doing Kaizen. No one will lose their job as a result of Kaizen. I gave a job guarantee. And we had the IBEW at Wormhole. We had another union. And of course, people said, you guys can't do that. You can't go give a union a job guarantee unless you get something back from the union. And you say, well, we think you're wrong. We think that's a very stupid way to think about things, because the people that are going to have the best ideas of how to get better are the union employees working on the shop floor. That's where you're going to get your best knowledge. And
Exactly.
you want them all to help you. And so if the first thing you do, if you go from eight people down to five people, and then you fire three people, and one of them is somebody's sister and one is somebody's cousin, and then you ask those same people, okay, we're going to do another Kaizen, we need you to help us again. They don't want to help you. You fired
They
my
will
sister.
manufacture their overtime. Machines will break, tooling will
Absolutely.
break. I mean, come on, you know. Materials will get lost, you know. But you know, the thing is, our when I negotiated the UAW contract there, we had I think we had 70 or 80 job classifications in the contract, and we negotiated a skill block program. We had seven skill blocks, so for each skill block that somebody earned, they got so much in their pay, and then when you got all seven, you became a multi-skilled operator. You got a kicker on top of that. And so people were clamoring to learn all these different jobs, and it made us more flexible. So what happened was, we actually put into the contract, and somehow I think they lost it over the course of time, but we negotiated, and it was I was on the negotiating team, that seniority would be second to skill blocks. So if you had 20 years and two skill blocks, and I had 5 years and three skill blocks, I could bump you. Okay. And that would, people don't believe me that we did that. And it was unheard of for a UAW in particular, any union, to give up the holy grail of seniority, you know. But we did do that. And we paid them for knowledge, not pay them for seniority, pay them for knowledge. And it was well received. I mean, people were clamoring to get all these skill blocks. The mistake we made, though, was we didn't do a good job recertifying people. Because let's say you got trained on a skill block, let's say CNC machining, and then you never did that for a year. You know, we didn't do a good job, and we had to recalibrate ourselves to make sure people kept those skills current, you know. But other than that, it was a big success, you know.
Yeah, but the ability of you to do that really, I think, comes from the initial no job loss guarantee, because
Exactly.
and I remember, do you remember Big Benny? Big
Oh,
Benny
yeah.
was
Oh,
a
yeah,
union
Benny.
guy, and
Yeah.
Big Benny was very skeptical about Koenigsaker and I at first, because we're telling him he's going to give him job guarantees, and we're telling him all these other things. And we're letting him know what we're doing with Kaizen. We got his people working on Kaizen teams. He was just skeptical. He thought, you guys are trying to pulley the woolly on me here a little bit. What's going on? I've never had a management that's been so honest and open with me. I don't know what to do. It was really kind of interesting. But
Yeah,
as soon
Benny, you know, and he ended up passing away. While I was at, when I was in corporate, he ended up passing away. But Benny would come. He challenged us once when I was running the operations. He challenged me and said, "Hey, you know, you're doing this. You're doing too many prototypes for Hino Motors, and it's really production." And it wasn't. But I would, because you know, the Japanese wanted 300 prototypes, where Caterpillar wanted two. You know, but. You know, I would say to Benny, you know, Benny, do you really want me to go exactly by everything that's in this contract? Do you really want that? You know, he'd walk away, you know. So he was a good guy, though. Benny was a good guy.
I know we had the same thing at Wormhole when I first got there. I gave the job guarantee, et cetera, and then we started Kaizen, and the union stopped the Kaizen right away. Hold on, wait a minute. It says here that you can't have salaried employees out here on the shop floor touching wrenches and moving things and whatever. So we had to have a little discussion, and we got past that, and the Kaizens continued, et cetera. But over time, We went from something like 63 job classifications down to about five or six. And we did that really without much of any problem or feedback. I mean, problems or issues with the union, because they trusted us. We were honest with them, and we said this is what has to happen. And we trained people in a lot of new job classifications. Not a lot of, you know, if a guy was running one machine and now he's in a cell with eight machines, he's got to learn how to run all eight. We just pointed out the fact that, hey, you're more valuable. You know, we just gave you a lot more skills. We didn't quite do the skill blocks the way Jake Brake did, but we had the same kind of concept. And, you know, it was still kind of an issue. For example, when we had to train some of our female operators that had started out just in assembly. They had as an assembly department. Well, we got rid of the assembly department and we just made cells. And so part of that, they had to relearn how to run machines, how to set up machines, change over machines. And they weren't too happy about that at first. But as we went along and as we, you know, we had to work with them and sort of do a little handholding. But they were great. I mean, they could do all that stuff. We didn't ask them to do anything they couldn't do. But I think giving the job guarantee is so important. But you're right, most companies, no way, they would never do, they had a union, they would
No,
never do that.
I fight all the time with my clients on this, and it's like, guys. And then the next question is, hey, how's our engagement scores? Well, if you're not doing Kaizen and people feel threatened that they're going to lose their job, you're not going to have engagement. I don't know what to tell you. I don't, you know, but well, you know, it's interesting because going back to the earlier days that you described earlier, that one of the things about the business at Jake Brake in particular was that we were such a bad supplier because the patent for the Jake Brake expired in the mid 80s sometime. And we were such a poor supplier, Art, and you remember this. Cummins Engine, which I think represented roughly a third of our business, pulled the product in, and they, when we were such a lousy supplier, we left somehow the old management left two high level executives in the lobby for an hour. They left. And they reverse engineered the Jake brake. They called it the C brake. It was exact carbon copy and took a third of our business away. The other OEMs came back, the Caterpillars and Detroit Diesel. Hey, we saw what Cummins did. You guys suck. You're going to have to give us a significant price decrease. So now you got a business that lost a third of its volume, and you got a business that the pricing on the rest of the business came down, I don't know what it was, 15, 20%, whatever it was. We were in dire straits, and if we and then the question was, well, we can't make this kind of change. We can't continue to do what we're continuing to do. You know, what are we gonna do? Make it worse? How the heck would we have making it worse, right? So that was the business. And one of the problems are, and you know, that I face sometimes, businesses that are doing well financially anyway, but have so much waste and have so much opportunity, there's no incentive. Because their comp systems are paying everybody, why would I screw with that, right? So that's really, really, really a problem. One of the other things is that you mentioned earlier that we were using Arthur Anderson, then we found Shingajitsu, and there wasn't a lot. The good news for us is there weren't a lot of consultants out there to screw us up, you know, which like today there's a million of them. But I'm holding up a book right here. It's a book by Shingo. It's one of the original Toyota books. And if you read it, I kind of say it's written in Janglish, right? But I remember sitting around the table with Pat Lynn and George Koenigsaker going through this book, trying to understand what is this thing telling us, you know? You know, and Shingo talks all about all the things that, you know, we know and love, standard work and SMED and all that. But this book, I kept this book because it's a, to me, it's a kind of like a historic book, you know? And then Norm Bodick, you know, took all these, this literature and translated it with a guy named Drew Dillon, who was a linguistic master. The guy knew, I don't know how many languages he knew fluently, but you know, he did that, and that was something else. One of the other things I remember, and maybe I'll jog your memory, when we were going to make the first cell at Danaher, it was the Caterpillar cell, which was again a big part of our business, right? But some of the production guys there wanted to do the Autolash cell. Remember the Autolash? The Autolash is a product that about as big as a pen, and it is probably as big as your desk. That was the cell. It was a small little assembly cell. Okay. And I remember Koenigsaker and you saying, no, we need to make a statement. Okay, we're not going to start small. We're going to do something big. And we picked the biggest the biggest risk that we had at that time was Caterpillar. And that's the one you picked and did. And again, a lot of people want to start small. I remember us moving equipment are like I changed my shoes or I changed my socks. That's how easy we had this down. We were moving it. How many times did we move equipment in that factory? I mean, it was almost like a monthly thing that we did. It
Yeah.
became it became it became it became muscle memory. It was easy.
Well, it's interesting, and I'm sure you recognize this. If you go in a company's factory that's lean, you'll see all the connections from above are flexible. They're not like a hardwired pipe. They're flexible because the maintenance guys learn really fast that, geez, if I hardwire this thing and I put it through a pipe, these morons are going to come and want to move the machine 3 feet or 4 feet or move it over here. So I'm not going to do that anymore. They're going to be all flexible connections coming down from the ceiling, which you don't see in most factories. But if you're going to a lean factory, you're going to see that.
You know, it's funny you said that. I'm just going to tell you a funny anecdote. One of our plumbers there had his ladder up on the. He was plumbing this pipe and trying to get set for the next machine move. He plumbed the pipe right through his ladder. And there was a guy in the factory that was an artist, and he did. Nobody knew who he was. He was a really good artist, and he would do cartoons of funny things that would happen, and that was one of them that he did. You know, so they had to go up and replumb the thing and take the ladder down. But just funny things that happen when you make change, you know. But you talked about that front office where you were at, and then we all said, "Well, you know what? We're blowing that whole front office away." Because if you recall, I had as CFO, I had the whole IBM 4381 mainframe up there. Okay, we had a big infrastructure, right? Halon Systems. I had a whole staff of IT people. I had about 10 IT people, I believe. And it was like, for what? You know, and so we blew away that system and went to my IT group went down to two people. Everybody else got redeployed. One of the gals, for example, became a buyer planner and things like that. And I moved my whole finance team out to the shop floor. Okay, I was on the shop floor, and I was buying an automatic screw machine because in honor of my father, he worked at New Britain Machine, and he worked on New Britain Gridleys, right? And so I was buying Acme Gridley actually, getting sprayed with coolant every once in a while, you know. And I remember Nikal coming in. He used to call me Money Man, and he said, "Money Man, you're on the shop floor," you know. He was like amazed that I had my team out there, you know. One guy didn't like it. He's like, because he. Suit and tie, and I'm not gonna be on a shop floor, you know. But a funny story was my father, who was a tool and die guy for 44 years, World War II vet, and all that, Iwo Jima. He said to me, "I want you to go to college." I was the first one to go to college in my family. He said, "I want you to go to college," he said, "because I don't want you to work in a GD rotten, lousy, stinking shop, right?" Okay, Dad. So I go to college, became CFO. With you guys, with George and you promoted me, and then I came home one day and I said, "Dad, you're not gonna believe it. I moved my desk to the shop floor and my whole finance team." "What are you freaking nuts? What the hell? What the hell are you doing? You went to college? What are you on the shop floor for?" He didn't get what we were doing. And let me tell you something, it was incredible to be out there. We learned so much about
Yeah.
what went on. You know, it was incredible. And I set up the whole transactional count Kanban and backflush system. We did two inventory transactions. That's all we did when we finally got done. Our inventory was so low. Arthur Anderson, we signed off on 2 years of not doing inventories because it was inconsequential to the balance sheet. And the only two inventory transactions we did is we received raw material and we shipped finished goods and everything else backflushed through the shop. You know, and if you want to know what we had, you go out and look at it. You need a
Yeah,
report.
or
It
he
moved
did
too fast. It moved too fast. Yeah.
the, yeah. Or he did the same thing at Wormhole with
Yeah.
backflush, whatever. But
Yeah.
if you go back to the sitting on the shop floor, et cetera, when I first got to moved over to Wormhole, one of the first things I did was to outlaw ties because all the salary people wore ties, right?
Oh, yeah.
And I said, look, I don't want anybody here wearing ties anymore because the operators on the floor say that ties cut off circulation to the brain. because anybody wearing one doesn't seem to have a brain. So we got rid of the ties, and that really upset a number of people, because they said, well, one guy, I said, you mean I have to get up in the morning and wear my tie out to the car and drive to work and then put it back on when I come home so that my neighbors still see that I'm a guy that has a tie? I
No,
mean,
boy.
that was the mentality that existed. But doing that, I said, I want you to be known for what you contribute. I don't care what you look, what
Right.
you wear. It's what you contribute. And so if you walked around Wiremole, you wouldn't know who's a salary person, who's an hourly person. It didn't make any difference. It was your contributions that mattered to us, and everybody understood that and felt good about that. And
Well, that's
we
threatening. But by the way, I want to tell you, Art, you owe me. I'm going to do the math on this because you owe me a lot of money.
I don't know any money.
I'll tell you why. Because I interviewed with George Conosaker, and everybody was in suit and tie. Okay. George was, Bob Pentland was. And so I got the job offer. I gave my 2 week notice. I said, hey, I'm starting a new job. I was working at Ensign Bickford, I worked at Lego. It's time for a couple new suits. I bought three new suits. Okay. So I show up the first day for work in a suit and a tie. And you have instituted the everybody gets six polo shirts, two blue, two green, two red, right? With the Jake Brake logo. And everybody had them. The shop floor had them. All the management had them. And I show up in a suit and tie. I go, what the hell's going on? Oh, yeah, we changed our dress code. So I'm going to calculate the future value of the three suits I bought. It's probably going to end up being like a couple million dollars, I think you're going to owe me. So. But it's funny. It was funny that all that happened, but it was really a good thing to do though, by the way. So, yeah.
Well, at Wearable, when we created value stream teams, which were based on product family, so you had a team leader for a
Right.
product family. We copied the same thing that you and Pentland did at Jake Brake, which was that team leader had to sit out on the shop floor
Yeah, engineers, everybody.
with their equipment, et cetera. And then we got rid of the planning to purchasing department, and we got rid of the production planning department, and created the buyer planner role. And so the buyer planner had to sit out on the shop floor with the team leader, and those were the two key people for every one of our product family teams. And they complained about it at first because it was pretty noisy. Some of them equipment was pretty noisy, but they were right there all the time. When something went wrong, they could see it without having anybody come over to them. It was like somebody pulling an Andon cord and saying, "Okay, come on over here. What's the problem?" And so, that worked really great for us, I thought. And all of that stuff kind of came out of Jake Brake and the things we did there, really, really helped us as we went along. But even today, things like that we just talked about, giving a no job guarantee, no job loss guarantee to a union, sitting people on the shop floor, getting rid of the ties, all of that kind of stuff. Most companies still won't do that. They
No.
think differently,
No.
and but the. But it's so, I mean, the job guarantee to me is just a no-brainer, because what do you think is going to happen if you start laying people off as a result of Kaizen? You're going to kill the whole idea of
I
Kaizen,
don't know.
aren't you?
I don't think you need a PhD in business to figure that out, right? And the thing about it was when I was up in the front of that office, up in front there, I could have been in California. I mean, we were so remote from the shop floor. We didn't know, have any idea what was going on, And like I said, a couple of my guys didn't like it, but I said, no, guys, I gave them 2 weeks. I said, I'm going out now. And then they weren't moving out with me, right? I said, okay, you got 2 weeks, guys. Pick any spot in the plant you want to go to. I don't care where you go. So they finally moved their desk and got out there. So,
Well, Danaher was in the early days of Danaher, we really set the tone in a lot of ways for what's happened in lean in the United States o over time,
Yes. Yes.
partly because of Shin Jujutsu and the contribution Shin Jujutsu made. I remember one time Conosaker and I were having lunch with Iwata, and we said, "Mr. Iwata, the stuff you're teaching us, this is the biggest strategic weapon that we've ever seen." Because both Conosaker and I had had some roles as strategic planners in our background, and so we said, this isn't some shop floor thing. This is a strategic weapon. And we said, how can Toyota let you guys loose to go out and teach other people this tremendous weapon? And he just looked at us and he kind of laughed and he said, look, I can tell you all about the Toyota production system. I can take you and show you the Toyota production system, but I bet you can't go home and do it. And that comment by him has stayed with me all these years because
Oh, yeah.
he was right then, and now 30 years later, he's still right. That's still the case. I don't know of any company that I've heard of that can initiate lean and be successful at it without some outside expertise helping them, at
That's
least
right.
for the first bunch of years, because it's a lot. It's a philosophy. It's a way of thinking. How do I look at things? If you and I went into a factory, we're going to see something totally different than a traditional manager is going to see.
That's
You
right.
know, we're looking at all the sleeping money and the waste and the other problems, and they say everything is fine. So I think that comment by Iwata was something that just always
Well,
stuck with me.
it mirrors the one. So I've done my, you mentioned the study missions. My first one was in 1990, April of 1990. That's the month that Ono died, by the way. So I never got to meet Ono. But I did like six of those study missions over the course of my career at Danaher with Shingijutsu and with Nakao and Iwata. And every time I took 30 executives over, Larry Culp was one of those, And so my first study mission, I asked that question. I said, how can you allow Chrysler and Ford and GM into your factories? And the answer was, what they need to know, they cannot see. And I didn't know what they meant at the time when he said that. Okay, I do now. Yeah, I mean, you just said it about how the thinking. How do you think? Anybody can put up an andon light. Okay, any idiot can do that. But what happens when that light goes on? What's the thinking behind it? What's the sense of urgency behind it? All that stuff is unbelievable. And the other part you can't see with Toyota is the brilliance in how they design their product. Okay. Because a lot of their manufacturing brilliance does resonate from the brilliance in their design, So yeah, it's unbelievable. And that's why you can't just copy them either. You have to change the way you're thinking. I talk about this a lot where, executives get to these prominent positions in a traditional company for doing something good. I don't know what it could have been, but now you're coming in and saying to them, you know what? What got you here isn't going to get you to where you need to go. For example, you worked really hard, Mr. VP of Operations, by avoiding changeovers. Okay. Regardless of the fact that the way you decide to produce is not how your customer orders, you did a great job trying to marginalize that. However, now I want you to do more changeovers. You want us to do more? What are you kidding me? What about EOQ? What about Ollie White, MRP? Oh no, we're not doing MRP anymore either. We're doing pull scheduling from the assembly all the way through the factory. What are you talking about? So all of a sudden, all these concepts and principles are total contrary. And by the way, that's why I did lean accounting, because all the measures I learned in school and all these, and I was a pretty damn good cost accountant, but we spent more time explaining why the standard was wrong than why we failed as a to perform. So we got rid of all that, right? But having an executive have to change what got them to where they are now is sometimes really hard to do, and not everybody can do it.
I think that that's true. And I think if you I like to think of just as thinking making things as simple as you can. For
Right.
example, in my opinion, every company, no matter what kind of company, manufacturing, service, a hospital, anything, is only composed of three things, right? It's a bunch of it's a group of people and a bunch of processes trying to deliver value to a set of customers. That's universally true for any kind of company. And if management could think that way and understand their business in that simple way, what to do becomes much, much easier, right? I mean, we always just said, look, focus on your processes, not on your results, because the processes you have now are what gave you the results that you have now. And unless
Exactly.
you change those processes, you're going to continue to have the same results. And the other thing is, when you say it's just a group of people, well, the group of people are the ones that created these processes. And unless you teach these people how to look at these processes differently and improve them, they're just going to continue the same way. And so you have to get everybody involved. I mean, moving to lean is all about people in the first place. I mean, what you're trying to do is change the way people think and the way that they act. You don't want to, it's not a thing about let's just throw out the people and get new ones. We have to just teach the ones that we have how to see things differently. But if you just think about those things, the people and the processes and the focus that should create, that's going to get you a long way down the path of how to think about what lean is all about, I think.
You know, Art, you mentioned last, I think in the last podcast that you and I did, episode that you and I did, how you wrote poems and you had this lady challenge you and she wrote a poem, you wrote a poem, and she
Yeah.
would ask you to write a poem every time. So I did write, I'll have to send this to you, but I wrote a poem about a cow. Okay. John Cosentino, that you mentioned earlier in 2017, I believe, called me up and said, "Hey, Mark, Nakao's in town and he wants to see you." I said, "Geez, I'm not in Connecticut anymore. I'm in Arizona." And he goes, "Well, we're having dinner at Max Fish in Glastonbury, Connecticut," which happened to be my hometown. I lived in South Glastonbury, and I also loved Max Fish, one of my favorite restaurants. And when are you having, I said, "When are you having dinner?" He goes, "Thursday night, 6 o'clock." I said, "Okay, tell him I'll be there." So I flew from Phoenix, from Arizona, all the way to Connecticut just to have dinner with him, right? So I wrote this poem about Nikhil because I think he's just a phenomenal individual in a lot of different ways. But here's the, I'm going to just read the poem to you real quick. So let's see. It's called "Ode to My Sensei Chihiro Nakao." Okay. "He came from Japan, an unusual cat, could not understand our mess. He didn't think that we would succeed, we'd buckle under the stress. His name was Nakao, an engineer. Said he worked for a guy named Ono. Claimed he learned spectacular things. He sounded like a virtuoso. Our operations," he said, "was oh so bad. He couldn't believe his eyes. As he walked through the plant, he shook his head. I thought, is this our demise? I started to give a pathetic excuse. He gazed at me as if to say, 'You're in transmit mode. You need to shut up. Please stop your verbal ballet.' He asked for my wallet. Is this guy nuts? He left it on top of my stash. I asked for it back. He firmly explained, 'Treat inventory like it's your cash.' My maintenance room, he was aghast. Disbelief, he started to utter. 'A doctor to operate on your young son. Would you accept all this clutter?'" And by the way, he thought the maintenance area should be like an operating room. That was his philosophy.
Yeah.
The quality guy, he gave a report. Nakao tore his report in half. If you can't remember your lunch from last week, what good are all of these stats?" And that happened at one of our acquisitions.
Yeah.
He said he said to him, I'll editorialize here as we go through this, but one of our new acquisitions are, this might have been after you left to Wiremold. This quality guy gives him a report on quality, and he rips it in half and he stomps on it. Okay. He said, "No good," right? And he says, "What did you have for lunch today?" And the guy said, "You know, I don't know what he said." He said, "I had a hamburger." "What'd you have for lunch yesterday?" "Pizza." "What'd you have for lunch last Tuesday?" Guy said, "Geez, I don't know." "If you can't remember what you had for lunch last Tuesday, what good are these stats?" Okay. So I'll continue here. An engineer said his machine was old and needed a new replacement. He t told Nakao it was 15 years. Nakao's response was quite an amazement. Nakao then asked for the engineer's age. He said he was 29. If a machine that old was younger than he, a new engineer will need to find. I told him one day that I knew standard work. He challenged and thought I was crazy. He looked at my cell and started to laugh. "Deluzio-san, you have been lazy." That's a true story. He came in one day to Jake Break, and I said, "Hey, we're going to work on, I don't know what, SMED, TPM." He said, "No, Deluzio-san, we need to work on standard work." "No, I know how to do standard. Come on, Nakao." Nicholson, I can do process capacity charts, combination sheets. I can do operating load charts. I can even take time observation by myself. I don't even need a partner. He took me down, and we had all our standard work posted, as you remember, Art. And on the standard worksheet, I had, he says, how many people on your standard worksheet? I said, five. He goes, how many people in your cell? Eight. DeLuzio, son, you don't know standard work. That, by the way, that's a philosophy that they couldn't understand with the Americans when they said they knew something but couldn't do it. Okay. That's a cultural thing, which I try to drive home with my clients. Don't tell me you know how to do something if you're not demonstrating it. Okay. Okay. I'll continue here. He fired us often when we let him down. It was a sign of respect. He hired us back at the end of the day, recognizing that we were inept. Nakao knocked us down when we thought we were good. Very demanding. He kept us humble. Despite all the press over DBS, our Kaizens, we sometimes fumbled. On a lighter note, he joked around. He warned me, said I'd be sad. Do not do Kaizen at home, he once said. Wife will get very mad. Concrete heads, he'd shout when we disagreed. Beavis and Butthead was really hot. He told me in private at dinner one night, concrete can change, buttheads cannot. Dinner with him was always a treat. Took a quick look at the roster. Our waiter's face was priceless at best when Nakao asked for a female lobster. Okay, now this is down in Arkansas, okay? And I'll send this to you, but I got the, in this poem, I've got the napkin where it was from the Embassy Suites, a little notepad thing. He actually drew out a female lobster, and he was actually a pretty good artist, and a male lobster, and he showed me what the difference was, okay? A kind man, he was hospitable too. He once took us out to eat blowfish. Prepared several ways, he said it was safe. Not really sure how he'd know this. A sushi bar was a gemba to him. His teachings beyond reproach. The sushi chef was one piece flow, never missed a chance to coach. He came to my house for dinner one night, loved golf, he taught my son. A consummate teacher he couldn't resist, as sensei, his job's never done. He could not believe that I moved my desk, a CFO on the factory floor, did not know what to make of my move. In his eyes, hope came once more. Money man, he called me, he wanted to know, thought I was just being cutesy. Kaizen is not why I go to Japan. I just like to eat their sushi. He anointed me as Ono's disciple. His doctrine, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. His doctrines, he made me commit to teach Ono's word to my dying days. He felt that I was equipped. To call him a mentor is a slap in the face. To me, he was so much more. A friend and a teacher, a father to me. His impact, I couldn't ignore. My years would be different, save not for Nakao, responsible for changing my life. I've never viewed lobster the way I once did, but finally did Kaizen at request of my wife. Now, often we meet someone so rare, God's work, his creation, a mystery. When the books have been written and stories are told, Nakao will go down in history. That's my poem. So, you know, one night at dinner, as you described, we were at Murasaki, if you remember, in Simsbury. And I did ask him about Ono. I said, Nakao-san, can you tell me what kind of person was Ono like, right? And he didn't answer. And I looked up and he had tears coming down his eyes. Remember how you said they revered him? He left the table. I thought, oh my God. And I had Shimbo sitting next to me through the interpreter. I said, did I do something wrong, you know? Shimbo said, no, nobody ever asked him such a direct question about Ono. So about 5 minutes later, Nakao came back and I just shut my big mouth. And he said to me, DeLuzio, son, would you like to know about Ono? I said, well, if it's okay, you know. He went on for like 45 minutes or so just with Ono stories, as you described, you know. Fascinating. And Ono was tough. Ono was tough. If you believe just half of what Nakao said, Ono was a tough cookie, man. And he told me how he had to sleep in the shop because he couldn't figure out what Ono wanted. And it finally hit him, you know, the Socratic method of teaching, how they're not going to give you the answer. They want you to really struggle with it. So you own it, you know. What an experience. And every time I had him in art, I was with him. I don't care where in the world we sent him. I was there with him, you know, and just carrying his bags, if you will, just watching how he worked. He was incredible.
Yeah. Well,
So
he's still working.
I know, and I want to get to see him too. We should probably figure out how to get with him. I think John still uses him, isn't he, up in Connecticut?
I don't know. I think he's mostly just consulting in Japan these days. I don't think he's doing
Oh,
the
he
travel.
is.
He's 84 years old.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
He's moving outside of Japan. And last time I was in Tokyo, I tried to talk to Mr. Niwa, and he's older than Nakao, and he's just not in good enough health to even do a phone call when I was there last time.
Yeah, Niwa, believe it or not, was my first sensei, my very first Kaizen at Jake Break. And I understand so he's the only one left besides Nakao of the five. I think all the others passed. And Niwa was tough because we had a I don't know if you remember Danny Mancini, who was a union guy. And at the time, Jake Break was allowing smoking on the shop floor. And he couldn't understand why we allowed smoking, even though all those guys smoked. So he actually took the standard work combination sheet. He set up a little tray by the machine, you know, unload, load, smoke cigarette, and he put it in the standard work combination sheet as a sequence. Okay, I'll never forget that. I'll never forget that. And if you're gonna do it, you're gonna do it in a standardized way, you know.
I remember one time with Mr. Niwa, he was screaming at this Kaizen team, right? He just screaming. The veins on his neck were popping out and up
Oh, yeah.
there. Just he went on for like 5 minutes, just screaming. And the interpreter was this young lady and kind of small. And she, after that, after Niwa's tirade, she didn't know what to do. So she looked at us and she just said, "Mr. Niwa thinks you shouldn't do it that way." And we said, "Wait, that's not what Mr. Niwa said. Whatever he," she said, "well, I can't translate that.
He went on a 5-minute tirade and she gives you a 3-word answer, right?
No, she said, "Mr. Niwa thinks you shouldn't do it that way." So that's not what he said. He said something else. But it was always a difference. We learned right away at in Danaher when we started. We had Arthur Andersen Consulting, and they want to do PowerPoints, and they want to do all this analysis and all that kind of stuff. We never ever got a written report from Shin Jiu-Jitsu that I can recall. Nothing. We didn't ask for one. We never got one. It was just, what do we want to work on? We'll go out on the shop floor with you, and we'll show us what the problems are. We'll help you see the answers to it. And it was always a learning experience. It was never a presentation or any of that kind of stuff because we didn't need that. We learn more by just doing things as opposed to some big presentation in a conference room someplace. We never had that with them.
You know, I pinch myself sometimes because I said, how did they end up there? You know, I was at the right place at the right time. But ironically, though, I initially refused the offer from George Koenigsaker and Jerry Hess, who was the VP of finance at the time, simply because there's a guy, there's a controller there that they had. And he took me out to lunch to interview. I was going to work for him. And so, after about five drinks at lunch, I said, okay, there's a problem here. But he said, yeah, these guys are trying to do this just in time stuff. It's not going to work. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, if I'm going to come in here and augment the accounting system to reflect, you know, what we now call lean, I ain't working for this guy. So I said, no. Koenigsaker went back at me and came, he asked, and if he didn't come back to me, I don't know where I'd be today, but you know, he came back and said, no, we want you. And we changed the reporting order where I would report right to the CFO at the time, which I eventually became the CFO. And so that's how that worked, you know. And I'm thinking, what if they didn't come back after me? What happened then? What would happen then? You know,
Yeah.
so because this has been an unbelievable career that I just kind of fell into, you know, and which is, you know, wouldn't trade it for the world. So.
Well, we have certainly learned a lot from Shin Jiu-Jitsu, and the people that have stuck with that and carried on what they taught us have been very, very successful. And I look around the whole lean community and people are too anxious to go to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. They just forget Kaizen. We don't want to do that anymore. We know how to do that. and they just go off onto the next thing. And I see people they're trying to do Six Sigma as a strategy for the business, or they're trying to do
No.
they go to the A3 as a methodology or something like that. We all the years that I was doing Kaizen and changing businesses, I never even knew what A3 was. I never heard of it. And then once I understood what it was, I said, "Oh, I know what that is. That was the first sheet in all of our Kaizens." We filled out a sheet that looked just like that to sort of say, "Here's the present situation. Here's the future situation. Here's what we want to do." And the gains we got on every Kaizen were so astronomical that I just can't understand how people can do a Kaizen, see these tremendous gains, and then just say, "Oh, well, that was interesting. Well, maybe we'll do that again in another 6 months," and just not go forward. How can you not do
How
that?
many people, let me ask you this question. How many people have asked or said to you over your career, because they said it to me, I got to imagine they said it to you. They would ask this question and say, "Hey, what's after lean? What's after lean? Show me your standard work combination sheet first, okay? Show me one," And that's Toyota. They've been doing it for 80 some odd years. So why don't you ask them what's after lean? I mean, well, they don't call it lean, but we all understand that lean was the term coined in The Machine That Changed the World by Womack. And so yeah, it's TPS really is what we're talking about. But what's after lean? Are you kidding me? You're not even in nursery school yet. Okay. My God, what's after lean?
It's funny, years ago, I introduced Shin-Jitsu to Boeing, right? And Boeing became one of their biggest clients. They were doing like 300 weeks a year of consulting and stuff like that. Anyway, they asked me to come out and give a presentation, and I remember going out there and giving the presentation. And this is after they had been doing lean for quite a number of years. And I said, "Well, look, you have to understand, you guys have made some progress, but you're still only in kindergarten." And I didn't think anything of that. The next day, the organization within Boeing, I think it was the finance department that was organizing this conference, they had a newspaper that they had. And on the front page of the newspaper the next day is a big headline that says, "Burns says Boeing only in kindergarten." And I said, "Oops." I said, "Oh,
you were probably being gracious, by the way.
yeah, I was just trying to, get their attention," and all of a sudden it became a headline in one of their internal newspapers.
I knew a guy that worked in the fuselage. It's now Spirit Airlines, which I think Boeing's going to buy back from them now, but that makes the fuselages. And one of the Shin-Jitsu engineers, I don't know who it was, it might have been Nakao, said, "We're going to put this on a moving line," because Nakao showed me at Pratt & Whitney an aircraft engine on a moving line. Okay, he set that up. He took me down to Middletown, Connecticut to see it. But they want to put the fuselage on a moving assembly line, and the engineer said, "You can't do that. You know how heavy this thing is. There's no way we're going to do it." So the Shin-Jitsu engineer took a rope, tied it to the nose of the plane, and tied it onto one of our drill chucks on a DeWalt drill, okay, a battery operated art. And he stood there and he pushed a button on the drill. The drill started turning around, the rope started going around the drill, the chuck, and the plane started moving. Okay. All of these, you can't do that. That word should be struck in from anybody's vocabulary. The word can't, it's you can't do that, and it's just incredible. Dealing with these guys, and that's the kind of thing they bring to the table,
Well, I read the early Shingo books and Ono's book, etc. And they told you a lot of detail. That was all good. But to me, the most important things out of those books was the philosophy. The
right.
philosophy that they would explain to you why. Why do we want to do it this way? Why do you want to look at it this different way? Because, as with lean, a Toyota production system, whatever you want to call it, you're looking at everything the opposite way the traditional Western companies look at things.
That's right.
They look at it one way, we look at it a different way. And it's the philosophy. And I think that's why it's so difficult for companies to do this, because it's so different than the philosophy that they've grown up with and learned for the last 20, 30 years. It's like somebody come walking in and saying, "Look, everything here is no good." Well, I can't accept that. I've been doing this for 30 years. I've risen up to be the CEO. You can't just walk in here and tell me everything's no good. Say, well, yeah, we can, but you're just not going to listen. You're not going to listen to us. You're just going to throw us out. And but unfortunately, that's the state that we're in. I mean, lean hasn't really taken off or caught on as well as it should have by now.
No, it's a shame. It's a shame. You know, and I guess the thing is too, you know, people ask me like, hey, what was the culture like at Danaher? I don't know. Which are your 200 facilities you want to talk about? You know, because they all had different cultures to some degree. But the one thing that was a consistent, and everybody likes to start with the tools, right? And I'm not trying to down the tools. You got to be really good at the tools. Okay, great. Standard work and all that. But the one thing that we made sure was try to make sure was consistent across the company in every facility were the principles, because I don't give a darn if you have a lemonade stand, you're making jet engines, you're making periscopes, you're making wormhole products. The principles never change. And so we were relentless in DBS on the principles, okay? And we always brought them back. Whenever somebody would ask me a question, hey, how would you handle this? First thing I do is consult the principles, okay? And of just in time, of safety, quality, delivery, cost, of never passing a product or a piece of information on that's not quality is not assured, right? I always go with the principles of flow, for example, before you pull and never push, you know. And if you stick with the principles and try to organize yourself around the principles, then when you do the tools, it's a lot easier in that regard. But you know, that's one thing I really try to push across Danaher was we're all going to talk the same language when it comes to the philosophy and the principles. And you know, and then we'll talk about the tools. Everyone wants to start with the tools, you know.
Yeah, I know, but like when I give a presentation to a company or whatever, I say, look, all we're trying to do is four things. We're trying to work the takt time. We're trying to do things in a one piece flow. We're trying to establish and hold on to standard work, and we're trying to have a pull system. And if the CEO of your company every day just ask you, hey, is everything working to takt time? Is everything in a one piece flow? Do we have standard work every place and are people adhering to it? And do we have a pull system all the way from our vendors out to our customers? And if you can say yes to all of those every day, you're going to be a pretty damn good company. And so don't make it complicated. Just, like you said, think about the simple, fundamentals that you're trying to achieve. You don't have to make it any more complicated than that. You don't. But most companies will make it very, very complicated,
Well, look,
Yeah.
the you know the Gemba boards have taken over. Everybody thinks lean is about Gemba boards and about whatever Kata is today. And the cow kind of laughed at it when I talked to him about Kata, but he goes, "No, Toyota didn't do that," you know. And I look at what people, you know, pass for lean, but they're not doing standard work, okay? And everything that you do should be exactly what you said. It should be, how do I assure we're hitting our takt time? Our operators are working the standard work, and when I can't do that, I Pareto those reasons why, and those are my next guy's hands, right? But if you don't have standard work, I had one client say to me, Mark, do you realize how long it's going to take to put standard work in? No, why don't you tell me? I've never done it before. I mean, do I realize you have never done it? How do you know how long it's going to take? You don't even know what it's about. But it's amazing what passes for lean today.
It's kind of like if you're looking at solving a problem, you're going to start a Kaizen. I always think the first question has to always be, what's the takt time? Because if you don't know what the takt time is, how do you know what it is you're trying to do? How do you know? Takt time just says this is the pull of the customer. This is the rate of customer demand. If I don't understand that, I might automate something to make 10,000 a day when my demand is only 200 a day because I didn't understand the takt time, right?
Well, it's interesting because takt time somehow is really hard for people to understand what it is. And they confuse it with cycle time, they confuse it with lead time, they confuse, you know. And I have actually one of my episodes on this podcast is on takt time itself and what it's all about. And you know, I had one guy tell me, I made a lot of productivity gains that brought down my takt time. Really? So I said, oh, so you're in sales. You must have sold a lot more product to get your takt time below to be faster, right? He just looked at me. What do you mean? You know? So it's for some reason that's a tough one for people to understand. I don't know why, but it is. It's not that hard, but it is, you know. But well, Art, look, this was super. So, you know, again, I want to go back to your book, The Lean Turnaround Answer Book, and there's a chapter. Is it one chapter that's in there on this particular topic?
On well, there's a
Or
one
is it spread throughout?
on Danaher, but also there's one on tack time, there's one on flow, there's one on standard work, there's one on pull, all that kind of stuff. There's a several on setup reduction and how important that is. You know, we even talk about what happens when make the month meets lean. You know, what happens then? You know, those two aren't very compatible.
Used to play hockey, right? You should know the hockey stick routine, right? I mean,
I know.
right, this has been great. So this is the third one that you've been on my podcast, which I think is phenomenal. And let's do some more. I mean, I'm sure there's a million things we could talk about. And I think we just
Well,
scratched the surface on Danaher.
take a look in the answer book and you'll find several different chapters in there that would be good subjects for a podcast. You know, it's
Yeah, they
a
would be. And I'll tell you right now, I'll look at that because I think there's certain things that people are struggling with today more than others. And so I will do that. And we'll follow up with the fourth episode. That'll be great.
okay. That'd be great. I'd enjoy it. It's always fun.
Okay, Art, good seeing you. Do I owe you a dinner now or you owe me a dinner? You owe me a dinner because of the suits. So we'll make sure that happens. So
I never heard about these suits before.
of course not. Well, you were the hey, I was just a little punk back then, and you hired me. I wasn't going to go, you know, complain to the head of the company. I mean, you know, I was trying to survive, you know. But
Mean,
now that
all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you want reparations for suits.
I want reparations. Oh, and ties too. I bought ties and shirts too.
Oh,
So,
ties. Don't
all right, my
worry.
friend.
Ties cut off circulation to the brain, so
Oh,
I'm
it does. And
not
they also get caught in machines too, right?
complaining
So,
about
but all right, my friend. Well, thank you very much. We'll get this out, and we'll be coming back to you on some other topics. So,
that. All right. Good luck,
all right.
Mark. Yeah, good.
Thanks a
Always.
lot.
All right. Always
Thanks,
fun.
Art. Bye
Take
bye.
care. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Lean 911 podcast. I'll be happy to address your questions or feedback on future episodes. Email me at mark@lean911.com. You can check out our other episodes by visiting our website at lean911.com, our YouTube channel, wherever you listen to podcasts. This is your host, Mark DeLuzio. Thanks for listening.